To answer is human, to question is divine. Welcome to the world of the Hidden Gateway, an exhilarating podcast exploring the concepts humans have been struggling with since the dawn of existence, such as, who are we? Is there such a thing as good and evil, or are they arbitrary constructs? Does the paranormal exist? How can we evolve to a higher state? Can our mind influence what we term as reality? Providing a transcendental approach combined with hard-nosed humanistic analysis, we invite you on a journey to question your worldview in this theater of life. Join our host, Justin Williams, as he explores the outer realms of faith, the supernatural, human potential, and even our concepts of the universal creator with a fascinating array of guests. This is the unseen world, magical, mysterious, and mystical, where your only limitation is your imagination. This is the Hidden Gateway.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Hidden Gateway podcast. I'm your host, Justin Williams, and today we welcome back Derek Jensen to the show. Hailed as a philosopher-poet of the environmental movement, Derek is author of 25 books, including The Myth of Human Supremacy, Endgame, and A Language Older Than Words. He holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and has taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison. He has packed university auditoriums, conferences, and bookstores across the nation, stirring them with revolutionary spirit. Derek, welcome back to the Hidden Gateway podcast. How you doing?
Oh, thank you so much for having me again. I'm doing okay. How you doing?
I'm doing good. And like I said, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Absolutely loved our conversation. I believe it was earlier this year, maybe late last year. Definitely received some great feedback, and wanted to get you back on this time to cover some topics that may be a hard conversation for a lot of people, but I think it's something that people need to hear, and that's trauma. I remember doing our first conversation. We didn't discuss trauma, but you did touch on it a bit because you had your fair share of experiences as well. And what you said at that time really resonated with me because I've had my fair share of experiences with trauma too in my youth, like you. So, if you would, Derek, please start off by, you know, giving us a little bit of background. Go back to your youth, right, where you grew up and what that environment was like.
So how about if I have a book that I have just finished, and I'm going to start looking for a publisher pretty quick. Okay. And it's about that topic and introduces it. So how about if I read like the first couple pages of that?
Perfect. Thank you.
Hold on. Eck. Well, maybe I won't read a couple pages of that because I just have a brand new computer and it's not. Oh, there it is. Okay, great. I will. When I was a child, my father was extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. None of us survived. Oh, we continued to breathe, sometimes, you know, the times, as shallowly as possible, so we could move as little as possible, so we could be as unnoticed and unnoticeable as possible. Continued, sometimes, to sit bolt upright, unmoving except for wide, unblinking eyes that jumped to any movement. Continued to eat, like the time my father leapt over the dinner table to get at my brother, and I continued to try to eat, because that's what you do at the table, and because I didn't want to be noticed. But did we survive? I don't know, because I don't know who we would have been without my father's teachings. But I do know one thing. We each in our own way learned to persist. We learned to be mules, to be impervious to whatever happened. Oh, we'd break, and we'd plead, and we'd cry, and we'd run. But somewhere inside each of us stood a mule who could and would take every blow and not give an inch. Or put another way, inside of each of us was a box into which we could climb where we could not be touched. Like I said, none of us survived. I don't know what was inside my siblings' boxes. I've never asked. Inside of mine were stars and the irrigation ditch behind the house and the meadows beyond that, full of meadowlarks, garter snakes, cottonwoods, grasses, grasshoppers, and ants. The boxes of some people are full of music. Others are full of words, stories, books. Some are full of paintings. Some are full of beautiful places. Some are full of pets or other animals. Here's what I learned about boxes as a child. The box must be strong enough to withstand any amount of battering, yet small and light enough to be with you always. It must be constructed such that you can dive inside almost instantaneously, faster than a slap, certainly faster than the door quietly opening and shutting in the dark. And you need to train yourself to be able to find that entrance to the box no matter what else is going on. You need to be able to move instantly from deep sleep. Wait, sleep can be deep? Who knew? And dive into the box with no discernible transition from sleeping to waking. You need to be able to get into the box while you're running and dodging. You need to be able to get into the box while sitting on a couch watching someone else get beaten. Get into the box without moving a muscle. The box is transparent and permeable, so that at every moment you can see and hear and feel everything. And I mean every slightest hint of movement, every slightest change in musculature that might indicate a change in mood that goes on outside the box. Your life depends on this. At the same time, the box must be completely opaque and impermeable, such that you're able to protect yourself from even the slightest awareness of what's happening to everyone, including yourself, outside the box. Your life depends on this as well. The box must simultaneously allow you to perceive everything and to be aware of nothing. So that's sort of a quick introduction to that. You know, my father, like I said, was violent, and we and then another part of this that's pretty interesting is that, in a sense, you know, most of our childhood, for me and my siblings, was not spent that much different than most people's childhood. You know, most of it was spent playing or doing homework. And it's not like every moment was filled with terror. It becomes normalized. It's just,
right.
It's what you know. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so that's a quick introduction to, and then of course, another part of this is that you become sort of a family of amnesiacs or a family of liars, in that, you know, nobody can survive this. So you have to do a lot of pretending that it's not going to happen again, or pretending that you have to have these strange belief systems. Like, you believe that if you can just do the dishes, that it had to do with how well you clean the dishes, and that if you just clean the dishes well enough, that it won't happen again. Or if you just act smart enough or stupid enough, or if you act still, if you're still enough, if you make little enough noise, because you can't, you attempt to take control of what you can control, because it's, you know, as unbearable as it may be, it's even more unbearable to think that you don't actually have any control over it and it has nothing to do with you. Anyway, I don't know if that's the direction you wanted to go with this, but that's one place we can start.
Yeah, absolutely. And first and foremost, thank you so much for reading that, those chapters out of your book. Those were very heartfelt and very, very authentic as well. And I couldn't help but think of my youth and some of the things that I experienced as you were reading that. So I want to talk about your father a bit more. My first question for you, Derek, what do you feel, or what do you think caused your father to abuse you and your siblings? Was he an unhealed person? Had he experienced abuse as a child from your grandparents and then passed that on to you and your siblings? Or did he have an issue with narcotics or alcohol? Or what was the purpose or the reason that you think is the reason for it?
I think that I don't, I'm not going to say all abusive behavior, but I think most abusive behavior emerges from prior unmetabolized trauma. And I don't know. Obviously, I wasn't there when my father was a child, but What I do know, and actually I wasn't there for this either, but what my mom always said is that her first beating came in front of his parents, and they approved. And that the family lore was that that had been a routine part of his childhood, was to be beaten as well.
Wow. Okay.
And so many, I mean, there's a couple ways we can look at this. One of them, so I used to teach at Pelican Bay, and you know, some of my students there, frankly, were some of my students. It was really interesting. I've never really done drugs. I haven't thought much about drugs, but a lot of my students, I became politicized about the whole war on drugs by teaching there, because a lot of my students were doing life in prison for drug deals gone bad or something, and it was so clear that for some of them, if you kept them off the heroin, they would have been perfectly fine neighbors and fine people. Mm-hmm. And they were people with basically an illness that, and then there were some who were just straight up sociopaths. Right. And, one of the things that was really interesting was there was one in particular that I became friends with and introduced him to a bunch of pen pals, and because life in prison is just horrible. And the interesting thing is that very quickly, all the people I was introducing him to as pen pals, we ended up in fights with each other. And this is one of the things that people who've been severely abused, as he had, often end up destroying other relationships when they're adults. And I've thought about this a lot in the time since, and also because of my own childhood, that because their behavior actually makes sense in the context of an extremely abusive relationship. If you are being beaten, if you're being, you know, raped by your mom's boyfriends and beaten by your mom as he was, then it really makes sense to try to set everybody else against each other, to try to distract attention from yourself by creating problems over here and blaming other people.
Interesting.
That makes perfect sense in that context.
Is that like survival technique, maybe?
Absolutely. It's a brilliant survival technique. The problem is that all of these survival mechanisms that we learned as children in this traumatic circumstance can be maladaptive when we're no longer being abused.
Oh.
And so, for example, myself, I didn't go that direction, but one direction I went that was that has controlled much of my life is just intractable insomnia. And that makes perfect sense when you are a child in a circumstance where you need to be able to get into the box immediately. You never sleep deeply because you're never safe.
Right.
And makes perfect sense then. But until I was in my mid-30s, I would check my closets and under my bed every night before I went to bed. And it's like, that's absurd.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
That makes sense when you're 6 years old or something and you're afraid of everything.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, and that's just one superficial manifestation. There are lots of other if you're damaged that so severely as a kid, it can have all sorts of ramifications. You can be terribly afraid of intimacy because you don't want to let anybody close, because if they get close, they might hurt me.
Right.
And also you can push people away because you don't want them to. And if I hurt them first, then they can't hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And
interesting.
You can have a very complex relationship with love, because you were completely dependent and you loved the person who was abusing you. You hated them too. So
right.
Love and hate can get all mixed in.
Right.
And love and fear can get all mixed in together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I haven't said this publicly very often, but I had some issues with this when I was in my 30s. There were a couple, three women I dated in a row who were pretty abusive. And I realized something important one day when there was this woman coming from out of town on the bus. And I was excited to see her. As I was driving to the bus station to pick her up, I was really excited to see her. And that felt like love, you know, to be excited to see somebody. And then I realized I was also really scared that she might be in a bad mood and that she would pick a fight. And I realized that for me, those two feelings, I couldn't tell the difference whether I was afraid or whether I was excited. And that was a pretty horrifying realization. And go ahead.
I was going to ask you, how did you work through that? Like, what did that process look like?
10 years of therapy.
10 years of therapy, okay.
Yeah, and also just, you know, recognizing, it's like, wait a second, I think my dial is messed up. Because part of the problem is that so often, you know, Jung has this great line about how we will do anything to avoid looking at our own soul. We will go to any absurd length. And that's especially true if you're talking about examining trauma. When I wrote A Language Older Than Words, which was about all of these issues, my symptoms became much worse. My nightmares, I used to have, before I wrote A Language Older Than Words, for the first 35 years of my life, I had multiple nightmares every night. I would wake up with night terrors multiple times a night. And writing the book, the symptoms became much worse because I was facing all this stuff. And I just had some sort of faith that they were going to get better afterwards. And they did. So it became worse. And then about 6 months after the book was over, the night terrors decreased. The nightmares stopped. I don't have nightmares at all anymore. But that book also is 25 years ago or almost 30 years ago now. And so the point is how I work through this is to recognize. And also, you know, I dated a couple three women in a row. I dated some nice women. I want to be clear that there were some very nice women. And then I dated a couple three in a row who were pretty abusive. And then I just quit dating because it's like, obviously my dial is messed up. My meters are messed up because, you know, if you get one abusive person in a row, it's like, well, that's just bad luck. Mm-hmm. You get two of them in a row, and like, that's really bad luck. You get three of them in a row, and it's like, it's not them. It's me making some bad choices here.
Right. You're attracting those type of people in your life, right? That's what was going on.
Exactly. Right. So I stopped dating for a few years. And then the first woman I dated again after I started up again was just the same. It's like, oh, I haven't figured this out yet. So I stopped. I was, you know, I didn't go on. I was celibate for several years again. And then I started making some better choices. But it's like I had to stop and recalibrate and also just ask myself, so why am I making these choices?
Right.
And, you know, Judith Herman, who wrote this great book, Trauma and Recovery, talks about the importance of telling the trauma story and making meaning of your trauma in order to move past it, in order to, you can't move past it ever, but in order to be able to live with making choices and how it can really control our lives. And then once you're able to really tell the trauma story and make some meaning of it, then you can. I mean, there's a great line she says that some survivor said to her about, I will live in terror the rest of my life, but at least I know the things I don't want in my life, and I know to not make those particular choices. And another thing that really helped was for me to realize that there was a sense, okay, probably the smartest decision I ever made having to do with those relationships is I put in place a one strike you're out policy for abusive behavior. So the reason I had to do that is not because I'm particularly smart, but because I realized that I was addicted. And I want to talk about that word in a second, that I was addicted to taking the other person's perspective. I was addicted to taking the abuser's side. And so somebody could do something really horrible. And I'm like, wow, that's really horrible. And within 12 hours, I've got to completely rationalize it was my fault. Right. And so what I realized, and other people have different issues, but that was my issue. And what I realized is that I simply can't have them in my life. It's like there are some people who are alcoholics who can still go into a bar and drink non-alcoholic beer and have a great time. Peter O'Toole is an alcoholic who quit because of the actor, who quit because of health problems, but he still loved bars. And so he could go to a bar and not drink. I'm not that sort of person when it comes to taking the abuser's side. I simply have to have them not in my life. So, you know, people, we all say stupid things and we all say hurtful things. That's all fine. Mm-hmm. But if somebody is mean to me once, and there's a difference between saying something hurtful accidentally or something, but if somebody like is intentionally hurtful, I cannot have that person in my life. I cut them off immediately.
Excellent.
And that's been the smartest decision I ever made.
Yeah.
And then I want to go back to that word addiction, because the word addiction, the word addiction comes from the root edict, same root, and it means to be enslaved to. And where this comes from is in ancient Rome, a judge would issue an edict addicting someone to somebody else, which is enslaving someone to somebody else. So, you know, there's that famous line about alcohol that you no longer drink out of the bottle, but the bottle drinks out of you. So at some point with any sort of addiction, you become enslaved to the thing that you're addicted to. And I realized that I was addicted to the behavior that would allow me to continue to be in those relationships that weren't mutual. And so back to the original question about my father, there's one more thing I want to talk about, which is Gail Dines, the anti-pornography activist, talks about how within patriarchy, men are, and she uses the F word, but I'm not going to use that here. Men are socialized to say, screw you. And women are socialized to say, screw me. And what she means by that, and this is not true across the board, but what that means is, or the way I take that is within abusive situations, you can be socialized to, the way Judith Herman talks about this is when you're raised in a circumstance of being in captivity. And okay, I want to back up. So there's PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is where you have something happens one specific time. Like you're in an earthquake and then you can be really scared being in a building. Or the example she uses is you're raped in a certain make and model of car. That make and model of car might scare you. And, you know, you don't want to get in that make and model of car. It makes perfect sense. It reminds you of the trauma event. And that's PTSD. And then she asked, what happens if somebody doesn't have a one-time event, but they're held in captivity, like prisoners or victims of domestic violence, where you're actually in the circumstance over time, repeatedly being abused. And she calls that complex PTSD. And with complex PTSD, she said, one of the things that can happen is that you can tend to perceive the world in terms of only hierarchies, that there are those who perpetrate and those who are victims. And the world collapses basically to four categories. There are perpetrator, victim, bystander, and rescuer. And those are the four categories that you perceive people in. And all relationships are hierarchical because, you know, and you don't have to say, but like, was it your father who was the abuser?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, your father has more power over you when you're six.
Derek, I apologize. There's been a lot of background noise going on for the last maybe 15, 20 minutes that I hear. It's a little distracting, I guess. And
so is it what sort of noise?
Sounds like somebody's back in the kitchen working.
Yeah, just a second. Lier, can you stop washing the dishes?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's over. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
This is a brand new system, and we don't know what works and doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you want to back up 15 minutes or what?
No. We don't have to do that. We can just, you know, we can just go forward as is, and I'll be sure to do the edits here. So it's fine.
Okay.
But last thing you asked me, was it my father who did the abusing? Yes, absolutely it was.
So, you know, your father, two things. One is your father had power over you. Mm-hmm. And he had power. It doesn't matter if he was nice or if he wasn't nice. A father is still going to have power over a child. A mother's going to have power over a child because a child is not capable of surviving on their own. Mm-hmm. So if And then when they use that power for non beneficial ends, that makes that, that forms an even more complicated bond, both with that person and with reality itself. There's a great quote that I use early on in the book, which is by Warwick Middleton: "The capacity for dissociation enables the young child to exercise their innate life-sustaining need for attachment, in spite of the fact that principal attachment figures are principal abusers." I'll read that again. "The capacity for dissociation enables the young child to exercise their life-sustaining need for attachment, in spite of the fact that principal attachment figures are principal abusers." So we end up having these complicated relationships with the abusers. And that's one reason, by the way, that I ended up identifying with perpetrators and taking their perspective so much, is that when you're a kid, you're... Another thing that happens in complex PTSD is quite often your capacity for self-care goes, it diminishes. And one reason it diminishes is because when I was a kid, whether I was happy or not was not important. What was important at every moment was whether my father's happy.
Right.
So we all learned to be able to read and respond to his slightest change in emotion or slightest change in musculature more than we paid attention to our own. So when people talk about identification with the oppressor on a personal level, on a political level, you know, we can talk about this on, you know, level of capital. It doesn't matter. It works on all these levels. One of the reasons that that happens is because we all understand, especially as children, that our safety does not depend on us. It depends on identifying with them and making sure that we keep them happy. And then that continues to ramify throughout our lives. Oh, I started to say a minute ago about we can get socialized under these circumstances. A couple things can happen. One is we can sort of voluntarily say, okay, it creates a black hole of feeling unloved. If you're abused, there can be this black hole of feeling unloved. And there's a couple ways that this can be approached. And we're finally going to get back to my father. Why was he doing what he was doing when, you know, was he abused as a kid? Is that one of the ways that we can respond to this? Okay, let's presume that getting beaten as a kid makes you feel unloved on some level. Or even worse, unlovable. It's not that you're unloved, but it's you're unlovable because your parents are supposed to love you and they wouldn't hit you if you were lovable. It's got to be my fault. It's got to be my fault because,
right.
Because then I can maintain some control.
Yeah.
If it's simply them, then I'm out of control. And that's even more traumatizing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so there's a couple ways that camps people can fall into. And of course, it's more complicated than this. But one of them is that if you sort of go the victim route, which is, if I let you do this, will you then love me? And so if I let you, you know, the classic idea is as adults is, you know, if the woman might say, you know, if she thinks to herself, okay, so if, you know, if I do this for him, will he finally love me? If I let him beat me, will he finally love me? If I let him. And then the other path it can really take is sort of the path on the other end of power, which is if she lets me do this, or if the victim lets me do this, that means they really do love me. Mm-hmm. And those two go together to create this self-reinforcing negative feedback loop. And so yes, my father was abused, and then it creates this black hole of feeling unloved that can never be filled. There's this great line by the psychiatrist R.D. Lang. How do you plug a void plugging a void? And he felt unloved, and if they will just do everything I say, then I'll feel loved. But that doesn't make him feel loved because the problem was not us. So then he has to push further and further and further. So yes, he himself, short answer is he himself was abused. Yes,
he was. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I talked to many people over the last couple of years here, and a lot of them say that their abusers were abused, and you know, they were abused by their parents. And all of a sudden you're looking at this intergenerational trauma that's going on, you know, this toxic energy that's been flowing through the bloodline for many years. Now,
there's a great line in the Bible about the sins of the fathers visited unto the children for seven generations. And it's
yes,
that's such a great line about trauma.
Yes. Wow. That is. It really is. I'm going to have to revisit that. I remember that one. I'm going to have to revisit that for sure. Now, I think early on, if I'm correct, you mentioned something about your father's teachings. You said something about survival, but your father's teachings, even though he was abusive, was there a good set of teachings that he passed along to you that you're grateful for? And if that's the case, how do you balance that? You know, being abused by this person who's supposed to love and protect you, and yet and still there's these good life lessons that was learned.
Well, two things. One is that in that particular case, I was being ironic about teachings because what he really taught us is terror.
Gotcha.
But that also goes back to, but you raise a great point that, like I said, most of our lives were not, I mean, he wasn't beating us 24 hours a day. And we had, you know, my father was a doctor and a very successful doctor.
Oh, wow.
And there were ways that we had very, like before I was nine, my parents divorced when I was 9 or 10 or 11. And before I was nine, I'd been in every state of the United States except for Hawaii. So, you know, we traveled a lot. We went a couple trips to Mexico. There were material benefits mm-hmm. with him, and it also, so on that level, I mean, you know, there certainly were some benefits, and then there were, you know, the terrible things. And one of the things that we do often as those who have been through abuse is we can come to, this is one of my problems with why I had to take the one strike you're out policy, is there was this one woman I dated who was pretty, who would pick fights all the time, and she was not very nice. Mm-hmm. And then I was about to break up with her, and I came home from being at work, and she had winterized my home by putting plastic on the windows. I was like, oh, that's so nice. And that basically bought her another 6 months of arguments. Because mm-hmm. I would just go, oh, God, she was so nice. I can't break up with her, with somebody who's so nice that they would. And so, of course, that's just. So the point is that, yes, there are definitely can be. See, that's part of the thing, too. It's a cliche in abusive relationships to talk about the honeymoon period after there's a big explosion. That, oh, and there's a great line in the battered women's movement, one good beating lasts a year. And that, again, you can have 364 days of pretty good stuff, right? But then one, you know, it only takes once in a while to make sure somebody stays in line. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with insults that, I mean, I hate to quote Dr. Phil, but he had this line 25 years ago or something about how it takes 10 attaboys to make up for one, you stupid kid. That, you know, that, I mean, think about this in your own life, that if, you know, somebody says to you nice things, that's really nice, but all it takes is one or two really nasty insults. And God, you remember those for years.
That's right. That's right. Now, with those women, those three women that you mentioned that were abusive, did they carry some of the same characteristics that your father had? Do you think that's what you were attracted to or what you were that drew you to them or vice versa?
Well, I want to be really clear that none of them ever hit me. It was, they were not physically abusive. It was just emotional. The thing that I was attracted to, that I hate to say, was the sort of emotional danger of, it felt such a relief when I would think there was going to be a fight and there wasn't, or when I would think they were going to yell at me and then they didn't. Wow. There would be this huge rush of like, oh, that feels so good. And I was young enough and inexperienced enough that I mistook that for love.
Wow.
Just a flood of relief.
So were you like subconsciously wanting to recreate that feeling over and over again because it felt so good?
I think so. And there's this line by, it's a couple things. One of them, there's this line by Judith Herman where she talks about how, I want to back up and tell a story.
Sure.
That when I lived in Nevada, when I was in my 20s, I lived near my sister, and my brother-in-law would sometimes go to the dump, and we would take my nieces and we'd all get in the truck and drive off to the dump. And one day he brought one of his daughter's friends. So there's four of us in the front of the pickup. My brother-in-law's driving. I'm in the passenger seat, and it's a bench seat. And then my nieces, my 4-year-old niece is sitting between us, and my 6-year-old niece is on my left leg, and her 6-year-old friend is on my right leg, sitting there in the truck. And, I had nieces. I was used to kids, crawling all over me. I'm used to all that stuff. I babysat, all that. I understand that. But this 6-year-old friend, she like squared herself on my leg so I could feel her genitals. And she was pressing down against me, and she was rubbing my hand in a sexually suggestive way. And I was young enough. I was 24, 25. I was young. I was creepy, but I was young enough. I didn't understand what it meant. And so I just moved her in such a way she couldn't do that anymore. And I moved my hand so she couldn't grab me. But I didn't get it. And then about a week later, the news broke in this tiny town that she was being sexually abused by her brother. And then I got it. It's like she had been, A, she was taught to act this way toward males, and B, and this takes us back to Judith Herman, there's a sense in which you could say she was trying to tell the trauma story. Mm-hmm. She was trying to act out. She was trying to say in ways she couldn't with words what was happening to her.
Right.
And so we see, and that takes us back to Judith Herman. She said that you see this all the time, that, you have men who come back from war and then they continually put themselves in dangerous circumstances. Mm-hmm. You see men or women who were beaten as children who will repeatedly put themselves in a circumstance to be re-victimized. Mm-hmm. And she said, she's very clear, and I agree with this, we're not trying to blame the victim, but she said, in her words, the data are very sobering. And it's very sobering in terms of people again getting putting themselves into these dangerous circumstances. And some of it is that we never learned how to protect ourselves. Mm-hmm. Another part is we don't think we're worth protecting, mm-hmm, on some level. Mm-hmm. And another is in some circumstances it can be that we have, like I said about myself, that my dials got messed up and I confused fear for love. And you have, wow. And also, because of the dissociation when I was a kid, a lot of my feelings got really damped down. And it can be something to feel some strong emotion, even if it's fear. Mm-hmm. And that can certainly happen, and certainly happens a lot, that we find. And I have a friend who, the way he says it is that we keep trying to put ourselves in that circumstance so that this time we can voluntarily end it. And then we can be the ones who say, this stuff ends right now. And until we do it right, we can end up, I don't know that I completely believe that, but I think there's some truth to it. And I know for sure that until we can make meaning of the story, we're going to continue to enact it until we understand it, mm-hmm. you know, until it was so important to me to have that realization or the other realizations along the way about, oh gosh, I'm confusing fear and love, you know, mm-hmm. until I did that, I'm going to be just continuing to act out on that until I mean, the same thing could be true for, you know, any other destructive habit, you know, you until you figure out why you are, I don't know, craving chocolate or, you know, whatever, craving too much chocolate, you know, anyway, so yes, I think it's really important to, but it's also really difficult to grapple through it. And that's one reason that most people don't is that, or so many people don't, is that it's really, it takes years and it takes a lot of effort to try to break a pattern.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. That is true. I definitely agree with it. Go ahead. You want to say something else?
And it takes, so when I was seeing my therapist, somehow we got to talking about, so at one point he said that, when I first came in, I was, he had a concern that I was simply being the good child because I was making so much movement so quickly. And he was concerned I was just being the good child, trying to fake everything to get his approval. And then I responded to that by saying, I don't know that. I mean, I hear you, but that doesn't make any sense to me because I came to therapy because I was really unhappy with who I was. And I was really unhappy with the patterns I was acting out and I wanted to change. And isn't that normal? Plus I'm paying you, for God's sake. And and I said, isn't that normal? And he said, no, actually most people come to therapy because their partner tells them, if you don't, I'm kicking you out. And they don't actually want to change. They're just doing it to placate somebody.
Right.
And the truth is I was miserable. And that's why I went to therapy. And to forget the therapy, that's why I wanted to change, is I didn't like the patterns I was seeing in myself.
Right.
So I worked pretty hard at it because, okay, there's this thing that anybody who's ever been an athlete, anybody who's ever accomplished anything in any field knows that there is short-term effort for long-term gain. And for a lot of us, we don't want to put in that short-term effort to the short-term, very hard effort in order to get that long-term gain of no longer being in relationships that are, you know, I was just saying to a friend of mine just yesterday, that so many of us are just wounds walking around on two legs.
Oh my goodness. And so many of us don't know it. On top of
exactly.
that, there are so many people in this world that have been traumatized that they don't know. And so I agree 100% with that statement, with your friend, that conversation you had with you and your friend. So true.
And if you don't know it, then how do you know that there's nothing to change? I mean, how do you know if there's something to change if you think this is just life and it's the only life you've ever had? You know, it would be so interesting if we could live 50 lives and then as we're growing up, we could go, hey, you know, this isn't normal. This is, I'm not supposed to feel this.
Right.
But we don't. It's like my sister, one of my sisters was in eighth grade before she learned that not every father rapes every daughter.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, whether you and your siblings thought that this was just what everybody experiences. So it sounds like she did, huh?
Yeah, and I certainly did too. I just thought this is normal. And if this is absolutely normal, if this is expected, then what's to change? There's nothing to change.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, one of the reasons I did it is I wanted to went through all this is because I didn't want to be an 8-year-old going around in a 30 and 40 and 50 and 60-year-old body, you know. Wow. It's like, wow. I wanted to grow up.
Yeah.
And for me, part of the difficulty was that I was not in my 20s. I wanted to be a writer, but I was too scared to write because writing is, you know, takes emotions and takes talking about the things that we weren't supposed to talk about as kids. No matter what you're writing about, it takes being honest. And I had this one evening, I was taking a walk and I realized, you know, I can't write because I was abused. I'm too scared. And then I thought, okay, I have a choice. I can either go the rest of my life with the best excuse in the world or the best reason in the world for not being a writer, or I can be a writer. Okay. And I got to make that choice. I made that choice that night. And it's the same thing. You know, having kids was never important to me, but if having kids would have been important to me, then it would have been the same sort of choice. I can either, you know, go through the work of having of becoming a person who would be a good father, or I can, and there are some fights that aren't worth having. This is a silly thing, but water skiing always terrified me. And the reason water skiing terrified me is there were beatings associated with it when I was a kid. And honestly, it was never worth the effort for me to work through that particular fear. I mean, I don't like cold water anyway. So had water skiing been important to me, then I would have wanted to work through that. Writing was important to me. Mm-hmm. Being in a healthy relationship was important to me. Right. So those things were worth working through. And there's other things like the water skiing that weren't important, so I didn't bother. Mm-hmm. And then there's other things like the insomnia that are just, I think I'm stuck with for life. Okay. And that's part of it too, is to just realize that there is no... You never become normal after trauma. You never become you. The trauma is your companion for life. Wow. That doesn't mean that you can't be happy. It doesn't mean you can't be in a healthy relationship. It just means, you know, like if you had lost a leg in a car wreck when you were six, mm-hmm. the leg's not coming back. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that you have to be unhappy. It doesn't mean you have to. It doesn't mean all it means is that that's never coming back. And it's the same with you. And it's the same with me, that we will never have a childhood.
Does that mean we never heal from the trauma then? Since it's your companion for life? Or is it more so that that's your story? That's a very integral part of your history that will always be there, that you're aware of.
I think it might depend on the definition of the word heal, because because I am a different person than I would have been had I not been traumatized.
Right.
And there are disadvantages to that and there are advantages to that. Okay. I couldn't have written the books that I wrote without having been traumatized.
Right.
And on the other hand, I probably would have had better sleep what I can say clearly is that I think we can function and we can be happy. Mm-hmm. But we will never be the same as we would have been. Mm. And if that's the definition of heal, then no, we don't heal. If the capacity and you know, there are some ways that we end up with some, this is kind of an overused word these days, but there are some ways we end up with a superpower, because you know that if you need somebody to drive you through the night, I'm your man, you know? And that's just a superficial example. There are you know, Judith Herman talks about how those who've been through trauma are oftentimes more clear about what they do and don't want in their lives. And also those who've been traumatized sometimes take up what both she and Robert J. Lifton call a survivor mission, which is that part of what I want to have happen with my work is for what happened to me and my siblings and my mom to not ever happen to children or any other children or mother mm-hmm. ever again. Mm-hmm. And I might not have taken that up had I not been abused. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, heal. I don't have nightmares anymore, you know, and I'm very happy with my relationship to relationships, and I'm very happy with my friendships and relationships. I'm very happy with all that. So yeah, I'm healed that way. Do I still have some eccentricities? I think so. Are some of those eccentricities probably derived from trauma? Probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that I live alone in a forest and am happy that way. Mm-hmm. But that could also just be my personality. I don't know. I mean, think about this for yourself. And I'm honestly asking, has having been abused, has it affected your parenting style?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I became a father at a very young age. My oldest son was born when I was 19. And then many years later, my wife and I married, and then we had two more children. So I have a son right now that's 26. I have another that is 15, and my daughter is 12. So my daughter is 12. So I noticed with my son, my oldest son, that I raised him differently than I raised the next two, right? Meaning being 19, not addressing the trauma that I experienced with my father. Looking back on it, I somewhat passed some of those things down to my son. I mean, I never beat him or anything like that, but I was very short-tempered. I had issues controlling my emotions, you know, things like that. But with my youngest two, it's completely different. You know, I'm older. I've dealt with a lot of the issues that I've experienced in my life from the abuse from my father. And I'm a better parent for it. And it was, you know, even when my oldest son was born, I always told myself from day one that I would never, ever subject him to the type of abuse that I experienced. So I was very aware of that, you know. And now that I've gone through so much over the last 3 years with additional healing and, you know, thank God for my wife with helping me become aware of certain things, I feel as if I am, you know, a great parent, you know, to all three of my children. And they benefit from that for sure, obviously. So I hope that answered your question.
No, it's great. It's great. And yeah, okay. So the people who made this ad are long dead, but there were an ad that was very important to me when I was probably 7 or 8 was a public service advertisement about how, I don't remember what it was. It's like 90% of people in prison, 90% of men in prison were abused as children, some overwhelming percent. And I remember at that moment thinking, you know, I don't know why that was more important than us actually getting beaten. But I remember in that moment actually thinking, I never want to do that to anybody. And, and, you know, there's an interesting thing. When I taught at prison, you know, we always hear that child abusers and especially child sexual abusers, you know, get beaten up or killed in prison. We always hear, I mean, it's a cliche that we hear. Right. And, you know, why that particular issue, I asked my students when I taught, and this was a supermax, when I asked my students that, and it's like, Derek, we understand why we're in here. We know where the journey began. It began because our fathers beat the crap out of us. And we're not doing this just randomly. We're doing this because, yes, we made bad choices later on, but it all started with us being beaten or raped. And they're very angry about it. And I don't blame their anger because, I mean, they're spending the rest of their lives in prison. Yes, again, they made some bad decisions. Like one of my students said, you know, it was a drug deal gone bad and he killed two people. But they recognize that it all started, in his case, with his grandfather beating the crap out of him when he was 4 years old all the time.
Wow.
And so they're, in my experience, they were very aware of where it all began. And, you know, I asked both Judith Herman and Robert J. Lifton, why is it that some people go through the abuse and then are able to, you know, at some point work through it and make better life choices, and other people, you know, spend their entire lives just on a downward spiral from what happened when they were four?
Yes, and that's true.
They both, not in a negative way at all, but in a very positive way, they both laughed and said, "We wish we knew." I was like, mm-hmm. you know, they're the world world. They're two of the world's experts on this. They're like, we have no idea why some people. And Robert J. Lifton said the same thing about the Holocaust. You know, being in those concentration camps, some of the people who came out became better people, were better people when they came out than when they went in. And other people, and all of them, you know, devastated their lives. They're not diminishing that in any way, but some of them became abusers themselves
yeah.
through what they'd been through.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's still a question I wonder.
Interesting. Now, Derek, I know you're extremely passionate about nature when it comes to nature. How has that helped you over the years, you know, in regards to processing your trauma and working through everything?
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful question. All your questions are great, and I really enjoy talking with you, and that's my favorite question so far. that, you know, you... Earlier on, we talked about, or you asked about how, you know, whether we thought that what was happening to us was normal, mm-hmm. whether it was, you know, how did we experience that? And the thing that was very, nature saved my life when I was a kid, and the stars saved my life. I would go out mm-hmm. onto, we had a lawn, and I would go out on the lawn. I would sneak out of my room at night and go lie on the lawn. And the stars would tell me, it doesn't have to be this way. This is not what wow. everybody experiences.
Wow.
And so it, you know, the stars especially told me that, but also the trees and the irrigation ditch and everybody else, they told me it doesn't have to be this way. And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, somebody who doesn't believe that nature can talk can say, well, that was a part of me that was telling me that. And I believe it was actually the stars, but it doesn't really matter. The truth is that the important thing is that somewhere you have to have that place, that something that is not, this is a word we don't use very often, but there is an air of corruption comes into everything in trauma. It's like everything gets polluted by the trauma. Everything gets, you know, and a lot of that is intentional. That there have to be, that's one of the things about abusers is there can't be any place that they don't control. There can't be yeah. any place that is not, that they don't taint or touch. And a great example of this is when I was a kid, I loved baseball. And one day my father said that he would play catch with me. And like any, you know, 7-year-old, I was thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
And then he threw the ball at me so hard that it put me in the hospital.
Oh, my Lord. Wow.
And that was the year I quit playing organized baseball. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't fun anymore. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is how we end up becoming stupid through trauma is I made excuses for that for decades. It's like, nah, he didn't do it on purpose. And then one day when I was in my 20s, I was in a softball league, and one of my teammates was playing catch with his 7-year-old son. And he was throwing a softball at him so softly that if the kid would have just put his glove down and the softball would have hit him in the face, it wouldn't have hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until my mid-20s I realized that no 7-year-old should have a ball thrown at them hard enough, even accidentally or on purpose, hard enough to put them in the hospital. I mean, right. it's just – but that had never occurred to me till I was in my mid-20s. That's where – you know, I was saying that the nature – told me it doesn't have to be this way. But obviously in some areas of my life, I didn't understand that not everybody searches their closet and under their bed every night before they go to bed.
Yeah.
You know, there were things that I didn't know that not everybody woke up terrified 10 to 15 times a night.
Right.
it's like, I have a friend who, whose husband was in the military and in combat, and he didn't talk about it at all. And then finally, she realized he. I mean, she told him, "You do know that you wake up every night screaming, right?" Mm. And he didn't know that, you know.
Wow.
And so we have these. So yes, nature saved my life, and then also there were ways that that we. I mean, were there things from your childhood that you didn't know were not standard?
You know, as I think back on a lot of the abuse I suffered as a child, my earliest memory of abuse was maybe when I was about 5 years old. You know, so I was in kindergarten, and my father beat my brother and I probably for about 30 minutes. And, you know, I had all these bruises and welts on me and all this. So at that age, I wasn't really aware. It was just something that happened. And, you know, that caused me to, that's when I began fearing my father. So I lived with a lot of fear and anxiety. Then fast forward to middle school, I knew my home was different, you know, than my friends, because I spent a lot of time at my friend's house, different friends, various friends, just whether we go ride a bike or go over there, play video games or whatnot. And, you know, I didn't know it then, but that was my way of escaping, not being around my father, especially in the summertime, you know. I was able to recognize the difference, right? And from what I saw, that my friends, their fathers weren't treating them the way that my father treated me. So I was at that age in middle school, so we're talking 11 to about 13. I knew there was a difference there, you know, and that led me to want to be around them more and their parents more so than mine, for sure. So
I have, it's a silly story without a real point, but it's kind of funny, I think, in retrospect, that I had this one friend who, his father terrified me because his father shouted a lot. And it took me, I mean, so one night I was over there for dinner and he shouted at his kid to pass the potatoes. And I suddenly realized that he never shouted because he was mad. He shouted maybe because he was hard of hearing or something. Uh-oh. And all this time I'd been terrified of him. And then when he's like, "Could you please pass the potatoes?" I was like, oh, it doesn't actually mean anything in his case.
Yeah.
And then after that, I was fine with his dad.
Right. And then with my dad, it was very unique because, you know, again, he was this alcoholic and he went into the Marines when he was 16. This is like in the 50s. And, you know, he was, I call it, like, he had this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality type, right? When he would drink, he'd be this monster. But when he was sober, there was some negativity. But for the most part, he was the nicest guy you want to meet. Like, people loved him, right? People loved him on the job, in the community, etc. He would give you the shirt off his back, literally. You know, he would do things for people. But when he, you know, hit that bottle, it was just this whole other character. And looking back on it, that was confusing to me. You know, I wanted the dad 24/7 that was sober and lovable, because he used to tell my brother and I that I love you all the time. And he was very affectionate in that manner, right? And he taught us a lot of great things in regards to life and how to carry yourself and how to speak and how to be well behaved. But that other side with the physical abuse, with the pouring the boiling oil on my head when I was in middle school, to wrapping a belt around my brother's neck and dragging him through the house. I mean, and you know what, Derek, the worst part of it all, and I tell people this all the time, yeah, that physical abuse was very hard, but he was very, very condescending. So the psychological abuse, that's what really did it for me. You know, that's what really did it for me, that psychological abuse, when he would talk about me in such a negative way, when he'd talk about my brother, my mom in such a negative way. It got to the point where, you know, I started to believe it, because this is dad. Dad knows all, you know, and he knows what he's talking about. And it wasn't until I was an adult when I realized, like your father, he had some issues that he hadn't dealt with, you know, that he had not healed from. He had issues with his father. He experienced a lot of abuse and racism in the military in the 50s in the South as well. Things obviously were much, much different back then. So he had all these things that he experienced and he never dealt with. And unfortunately, that caused him to start drinking because he didn't know how to process it. And on the flip side of that, we were the victims of psychological as well as physical abuse because he didn't know how to deal with things that need to be dealt with at the end of the day. So,
you know, it's a really hard question, or I don't know if it's a hard question. It's something that, you know, you asked early on. I think your second question was, you know, about my father getting abused. And I, you know, even with people as terrible as, you know, serial killers, quite often they were abused pretty horribly as kids. Mm-hmm. And that, and like I said, a lot of my students at the prison were abused horribly. And I'm pretty clear for myself that my sympathy for abuse victims usually ends when they start perpetrating themselves. And so it's like, I feel really bad. I have no sympathy for my father as an adult, and I have a lot of sympathy for him when he was five. And wow. I don't have a particularly profound point to make about that. It is something I think about because you see it, you know, when I was teaching at the prison, I kept thinking about how the people who really should be in prison were most of these guys' parents. Mm-hmm. And then we can take that back and back and back. But,
right.
You know, a lot of my students, they never had a chance. They, you know, I had one who was put out to prostitution at the age of four by his grandfather. And so he's being put out to be raped by, you know, semi-random men at the age of four. What chance did he have to make a life?
Yeah.
And, wow. You know, that doesn't excuse him killing somebody else because, you know, that other person didn't deserve it. I mean, if he would have killed his grandfather, then we have a different discussion. But
right.
I see this so often that, unfortunately, I think that part of the problem is I think that abuse is really contagious, you know, in that abusers create new abusers by abusing people. And it's like, you know, before, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but before we turned on the recorder, you were mentioning that you had a little bit of a sort of cold, stuffy nose, sore throat thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's a contagion, you know. It goes from you to your kids to their classmates to, you know, it's spread all over. And abuse is the same way, except that it's not a little germ vector. Instead, it's the trauma vector, it's. I mean, that's really how I look at it. That it is a sickness that spreads and. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how far to take this metaphor because I don't know what the antibiotic is. I don't know what I mean, I can talk about the cure individually, but we have, you know, I'm reading Ink Black Heart by J.K. Rowling, which is about, by Robert Galbraith, which is about, it's a mystery novel about talking about abusive behavior online. And, you know, there are just so many, you know, you look on Twitter or you look on Facebook or any of these, and there's just, you see so much abusive behavior.
It's everywhere.
And it's not, and I want to be really clear that that is completely different than abusive behavior in one's lifetime, because at 5 years old, you couldn't turn off your father. We can always just not go on Facebook or Twitter. I mean, that's the essence. The essence of trauma is being out of control.
Yeah.
And with online behavior, yes, there's online behavior that is nasty and mean, but man, we got an off button. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can always just use it. And so there's a difference there because nobody's forcing you to look at nasty tweets on Twitter or anything.
That's so true. But I think we've gotten, as a society, maybe we've gotten so immune to it to a certain extent that we want to see that. You know, we're attracted to that, you know, just kind of like you spoke of earlier, how you were attracted to these abusive women for various reasons. You know, so now society is in this area, in this space where we are welcoming and wanting this abuse into our lives. Right. And, you know, how do you fix that? I don't know if you can fix it. I mean, I think a lot of things in society would need to change, that a lot of people would need to be on the same page in order for it to go in a different direction, you know, but it's almost as if we're doing it to ourselves, right?
Well, there is a certain feeling. I agree with you. And there is this certain feeling of aliveness in conflict. There is a certain attraction. It's like, ooh, there's a headline that, you know, some actor and actress are breaking up and it's a really nasty divorce. And it's like, oh, let's get the gossip. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain, I think drama is always more interesting than non-drama.
Right.
Pretty much by definition. And this is, we're getting off topic here, but this is a thing I've thought for many decades now, which is, I think movies harm real life relationships one of the reasons is that by definition in a movie, you want to have drama. And so I think movie relationships are oftentimes more volatile than real relationships. And they teach us that relationships can be more volatile, because if you have, like, every movie we've ever seen about an activist, their partner has to not want them to be an activist. Oh, please don't do it anymore. Oh, I don't like it when you do it. It's taking time away from our relationship. It's taking time away from the kids, all this stuff. And they do that simply to create drama in a story so they can pull you forward another couple minutes.
Right.
But I actually know a fair number of people in relationships with some form of activist who are perfectly supportive of the activism, and they love it, and it's part of their relationship. Mm-hmm. But that's just not as exciting. Right. And so we see these. One movie, I want to make an exception to this, which is Norma Rae, that old movie. I thought that they did a really good job in that movie. Sally Field becomes this activist. She becomes a union organizer. And at one point, I mean, her partner, her husband, does get a little bit tired of the fact that she's never around, but he's still really supportive. And I thought they did a wonderful job of that movie, of showing the complexity of someone who's devoted to a cause. And yes, it does take time away from the marriage, but he's still supportive. Anyway, but you don't see that a lot of times. And so, yeah, back to your original thing. I mean, if I see a tweet, I'm actually not on Twitter, but if I see a Facebook post that is, oh, I'm having a lovely day, that's just not quite as exciting as if somebody has a post about, oh, what a terrible day I had, my boss got mad at me. I mean, that's just sort of generically more interesting.
Right, right.
I'm just saying to validate everything you said. I'm just agreeing with you. I should have just said I agree with you and shut up.
No, you're fine, Derek. You're fine. But let me ask you this. Do you think that's human nature to be attracted to that drama? Or have we been socially engineered to want more of that, you know, through movies, through various things that go on in society?
I think it's both. I think that there's I think humans are fundamentally contentious. Mm-hmm. I think that we snipe at each other all the time, just little itty bitty. I think trauma makes that worse. There's this concept I want to introduce, which is toxic mimic. And a toxic mimic takes the form of something and perverts the content. And a great example is rape, that it takes the form of sexuality, a beautiful, wonderful thing, and it destroys it. And that's one of the things abuse does in general, is create all these toxic mimics, a toxic mimic of love. You know, there's this love that you have for your father, that I had for my father, that gets toxified by all this abuse and gets made confusing. So I think that we just generically, gossip comes from, it's interesting, I just learned this like 2 months ago. Gossip comes from god sibling, like godparent or godchild, mm-hmm. and it just means a very close friend. Mm-hmm. And a very close friend with whom you can talk about anything. And one of the things you're going to talk about is, hey, did you see what they did the other day?
Right.
think that's just, that just is a normal part of human relating. Okay. We all do that. The problem is that, again, our dials are messed up so that we end up liking it a lot more. Okay. So I have a pretty good dial on gossip. I don't feel uncomfortable. I don't feel like it's here. Well, I'll just say what I mean, that there is some level of gossip I find interesting, but when it goes to a certain level of nastiness, then it's like, that makes me feel, going to use a childlike word here, it makes me feel yucky. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, if it's just itty bitty gossip, that's kind of fun. But if it's too mean-spirited, then it's like, it's not fun anymore. So I think that it becomes, I think the answer for me, and you can please do disagree with this, but for me, it's that, yeah, a little bit of it is inherent, but our dials get all messed up, first by abuse, and second by the fact that the internet, you're not actually in relationships, but you can say all this stuff anonymously. It's sort of a mob mentality. It can also get messed up by mobs that, you know, there's this, there's been so many interesting studies done on this that, you know, if you took any individual who, you know, to take some of the worst atrocities of American history, if you take any of the individuals who were in mobs who tortured and lynched black people, probably one person by himself wouldn't have done it. Two or three probably wouldn't have done it. Right. You get 100 of them together, and there's this other force emerges. Mm-hmm. And also, they would have had a more difficult time doing it if it's their best friend. You know, they would have had. So in the internet makes all this much easier, because you're not a friend. I mean, it's somebody in Turkey that you're saying horrible things about, or it's somebody in that you're never going to meet. Right. And then in addition, there can be this great experiment about this. That's great. It's an interesting experiment about the second voice or the second opinion or something like that. That what they did is they have people in a waiting room, and what the people in the waiting room don't know is that's actually the experiment right there. So they're in the waiting room to go in to see if they're going to be in this experiment. And one person in the room will say something really offensive. Mm-hmm. And then what they found is that the response of the people to that offensive comment is highly dependent upon the second person who says something. So say I say something really racist in this group. I'm part of the experiment. I'm not one of the subjects. Mm-hmm. And my job is to say a racist thing. And then the second person in the room says, gosh, Derek, that's really racist. Don't say that. Everybody else in the room was like, yeah, that's really racist. Don't say that. But if the second person says, oh, God, Derek, that's so funny. What a great thing. Everybody else in the room was like, oh, God, Derek, that's great. What a great thing. So everybody else is, it's like, so you, that's how the mob can form. One person says, oh, that's terrible. Everybody's like, yeah, whatever. You're a weirdo. But the second person adds their voice. Oh, yeah, let's go do something terrible. Then that starts to build up some momentum.
Yeah.
Yes, back to the original thing. I think that a little bit of it is inherent, and then I think it gets magnified, blown out of all proportion by abuse, and also by the impersonality of screens and mob mentality. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Thank you for sharing that. It definitely makes sense. Interesting stuff, Derek. Definitely interesting. All right, so I'm gonna take the conversation in a bit of a different direction here. So over the last 3 years or so, we have seen a lot of chaos and confusion in the world when it comes to, you know, COVID, the vaccine. We have some wars going on, and we have seen. Let's just go back to 2020, right? The George Floyd case, and then the riots that broke out, and such. Then you have all these groups, right? In fact, I know that someone very close to you had a horrible experience recently dealing with Antifa, right? Do you think that a lot of this chaos and confusion is manufactured by quote unquote powers that be, therefore causing this traumatic experience that a lot of people have had over the last few years? Hope that makes sense.
Well, I would be really interested to know your opinion on this. My opinion is not that it's so much caused by powers that be. I think a lot of it is a manifestation of increasing unhappiness among the population in general. Mm. And I actually think a lot of it has to do with the fact that real wages have been declining since 1973.
Yeah.
And people are. So one of the things I did that I was very proud of in 2001, I wrote the book Culture Make Believe. And one of the things I was very proud of is I correctly predicted how the right goes crazy when economies collapse. And I made a connection between economic collapse and a rise of an increasingly racist, xenophobic, militant right wing.
Okay.
And one of the things I used examples of outbreaks of the KKK in various depressions that the United States had, various economic collapses that the United States had from the 1860s through, I don't know, through the 1990s. I was really proud of that. And what I didn't realize for a couple years is that something I had completely missed in that book is that the left goes crazy in complementary ways, but not the same ways at all, but the left goes just as crazy, and I completely missed it. And so I wrote that book in 2012, and it's really funny because Culture Make Believe, where I criticize how the right goes crazy when the economy collapses, it was long listed, means it didn't make the official short list, but people on the inside told me it was one of the best 10 books for a major literary prize. That's great.
Excellent.
I did the 2012, I wrote about how the left goes crazy when the economy collapses. And that book was held by the publisher for 5 years, and then it ended my relationship with me, and it's destroyed my career. I never got published.
Really?
And the point here is not so much that. It's a little bit the point. But the real point is I think that just like with individuals who are raised in trauma, we don't know. We often manifest that trauma in ways that are unconscious. And we know we're unhappy, but we don't know what to do about it. And I think that it was possible, and it was fairly straightforward for many families in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s to be able to have one income to raise a family.
Right.
And that has become increasingly difficult as real wages have declined since 73. So in 1950s and 60s, kids growing up, ignoring all the trauma, ignoring everything else that's wrong with society, kids growing up could think, wow, we're going to have a better lives than our parents.
Right.
And that's not really been the case since then. And so there has been this, I mean, all I'm saying is that when Rome collapsed, people went crazy. And the American empire is collapsing.
Yes, it is.
And that is going to, one of the ways it manifests on the left is, I just find it so interesting that prior to the 1990s, the Democrats at least pretended, we both know Democrats, Republicans, two wings of the same party, et cetera. Right. But the Democrats at least pretended that the working class was their constituency. And, you know, I don't know if you remember Ross Perot talking about the giant sucking sound when they signed NAFTA, which was going to be all these American jobs leaving. But he was right. And Ross Perot is crazy in many ways, but he was right on that. You know, Bill Clinton, Democrat, signed NAFTA, which is one of the worst things that's happened to the American working class. Yep. Until by 2016, Hillary Clinton can call Trump voters, really what she means is working class poor in many ways, deplorables. And it's like, and don't get me wrong, I can't stand Trump, but if the left, which was supposed to be about working class issues, gives up on those working class issues, and I can understand why, because look, we're losing on the environmental front. Unions have been destroyed. The working class is not having a good time through international trade, et cetera, et cetera. We're all of those issues we're losing pretty badly. Well, at least we can go stick with personal purity. At least we can, you know, try to get some stupid comedian canceled or something. We can, and instead also, I mean, I have no problem with militant resistance, but we have, like, with, I mean, Antifa is not going after ExxonMobil. They're going after people who disagree with them on some very specific issues. And those are not issues of class. That's not, they don't go after the capitalists. And so yeah, I think the left has gone crazy. The right's gone crazy. So I don't think we need to invoke the powers that be in order to explain it. I think if you want to explain it that way, that's perfectly fine. I'm not going to disagree with it. And certainly there are a lot of issues that are being pushed with a lot of money.
Right, right, definitely.
I'm not going to disagree with that. But the fact, one of the ways I think about this is that no matter how much money you throw into it, the people have to be prepared for it because they're dissatisfied with something else. And the way I think about this is that Jimi Hendrix was immensely talented. He was absolutely brilliant. But he would not have succeeded with his style of music in 1924. Because society wasn't ready for his style of music.
Okay, right.
You see what I'm saying, getting at?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same. If society isn't ready for it, then you're not going to get... If society isn't prepared, you could put $1 billion into creating a right-wing militia, and it just wouldn't take, because people aren't going to go there. But if the... There was a sign on the locker room wall when I was in college that luck is where preparation meets opportunity. And so if you're prepared, a great example of this, I think about some, I was so excited during Arab Spring because, it's people actually revolting against these dictatorships and it's pro-democracy and yay, yay, yay. But in Egypt, for example, the winner of the first round was the Muslim Brotherhood. It wasn't democratic forces. And then the winner of the second round was basically the Western powers putting in whoever they wanted to take over for the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's because the Muslim Brotherhood was more organized and more prepared than the democratic forces. And then the Western powers were even more, they had more, even more money and more tanks and more organization than the Muslim Brotherhood. So what I'm getting at with all this is that I think it's a result of unarticulated rage at the collapse of the system. Yeah, that's basically what I, and also the fact that we are desperate because on many, many issues, I mean, the disparity between rich and poor is getting greater.
Yes.
And, like I said, unions, I mean, labor is just getting clobbered everywhere in the United States. And I don't see how we can make, if we're losing all those fronts, there's this line I love by Eric Fromm, which is, I affect, therefore I am. And if I can't change something on the big scale, at least I can break this window. You know, like at least that. I can set this fire. And is it actually useful in terms of bringing about a real revolutionary movement? I don't think so. Anyway, what do you think? Do you think that it's, I think the powers that be are happy with it, but I think they're funding it, but I don't think it's created by them. I think they're taking advantage of a pre-existing situation. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I like how you said that. They're taking advantage of a pre-existing situation. And I think that can be true to a certain extent. Now, do I think some things are manufactured? Absolutely. I really do. Because at the end of the day, we talked about money a little bit. I think someone's getting paid off of all of this. You know, when you talk about different wars and such things like that, even when you talk about the great divide with COVID and the vaccine, right? Obviously, pharmaceuticals getting paid, maybe some Congress people as well. You know, I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to greed. And I can definitely see them taking advantage of the situation. But I think that they add some to the pot as well to make it go even further, to cause a division, to cause a lot of the chaos and confusion for various agendas. For sure.
So I, you know, maybe I just have this too much on my brain, but I think about it like abusers, you know, there would be a trigger for my father's anger. And was the trigger legitimate? No. I mean, the dishes weren't clean enough or something, but that's actually not worth beating somebody over. It's not even worth talking about. But there would be a trigger. And I think it's the same that abusers, I think about abusers like a socket wrench, a ratchet wrench that, it tightens. And then as soon as there's an excuse, it tightens again. As soon as there's an excuse, it tightens again. So I think that those in power, again, aren't really creating circumstances, but they'll take advantage of anything that they, if they see the opportunity, they'll do it. And, you know, this really relates to, I mean, did your father deny after beating you, did your father deny that he did it?
You know, he didn't. However, I do recall one time when I was in middle school that he jumped on my brother really bad. I see it clear as day. He was on top of my brother, kind of straddled him. He was on his chest and he was just hitting him in the face, slapped him upside the head, hit him in the chest. It was just a very chaotic scene. And then the next day, we were sitting in the living room. My father comes in crying, and he approaches my brother and says, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have did that to you. And he literally told my brother, hit me, punch me. I deserve it. Hit me, punch me. And that was the only time that I recall my father acknowledging that he did something bad, except for the time when he was dying. He passed back in 2007. But when he had got sick, when he got sick in 2004, 2005, you know, he knew he was on his way out. I had spoke with his doctor, and his doctor told me that we need to prepare. And he went on this forgiveness tour, if you will. He went and spoke with people from years past. I mean, he found people from 20, 25, 30 years ago that he felt he did wrong and apologized to them. And yes, he said the same thing to me as well. He said, you know what, Justin, I apologize. I was definitely too hard on you and your brother. I apologize for what I put you through. Now, that doesn't erase everything that I experienced, right? But it does help. In fact, I was just speaking to my wife about this earlier today. It doesn't erase it. It doesn't change it, but it does help because, you know, a lot of people don't get that from their abusers, that apology, you know, and getting that apology from him. I mean, I remember it, but I really didn't process it up until about 3 years ago. And so after processing that 3 years ago, that sent me on this journey of opening all types of different emotions, you know. And I think I'm still processing it, amongst other things, to a certain extent as well. It's been very interesting for me, to say the least.
Well, I'm glad you got that. And the reason I was asking is because my father would deny it. And I never understood, and I will never understand probably, if he believed his denials. And I think the same thing on a larger scale is, do, you know, when those in power lie to the American public to lead us into another war, do they, are they just scheming, or do they actually believe their lies? And
that's a good question.
You know, it's, I ask this on every level. You know, it's, did Hitler, was he being purely cynical, or did he really believe that the Jews were bad and should be, you know, exterminated? Did he really believe that? Or, I think in his case, he was a true believer, but it's, you know, they've done studies of rapists in prison, and I don't remember the numbers, but basically 60% of them say that the sexual interaction was consensual. And do they actually believe this? Have they talked themselves into it? Or, and then of the others, you know, I'm making up the numbers, but let's say 60% say it was purely consensual. Another 30% say, well, she led me on. It's only like 10% say, yeah, I did something terrible. It's mm-hmm. very small percentage. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting, you know, that we talk ourselves into stuff. And I wonder, you know, to the degree that those in power are, you know, fabricating this stuff, are they actually just going, hey man, how can we do this? Or do they actually believe the justifications that they're putting forward?
I think it may be a mix of both. I think that a lot of those people in power are psychopaths, and I think that they truly believe what they are doing is the right thing, you know, and for whatever reasons that they have and, you know, that they talk about, you know, whether it be agendas or whatever. So I think a lot of them do, but I think there's probably some as well that, you know, they know they're lying. They know what they're doing. They know they want to manipulate. They know they want to start these wars to cause chaos, confusion, and various other reasons and money, you know. So that's a great question. That's a great question. Definitely something to think about. Food for thought for sure. Good stuff, Derek. Good stuff, man. Hey, I'm going to go ahead and – well, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Were you about to say something?
No, I was just going to say I'm starting to run out of steam here.
Yeah. I was gonna shut it down. I wanted to ask you one final question. I asked you last time, and I asked every guest that appears on the show to leave our audience with what I call a token of love, just simply something that you feel they need to hear in this moment. You've dropped a lot of beautiful gems, but one last one, if you would, please.
Well, I think the stars are right, and it doesn't have to be this way. And even if you were horribly abused as a kid, yeah, life can still be good.
Yes, it can. Yes, it can. And that's up to the individual. Thank you so much, Derek. I appreciate you. Hey, if you could just take a quick second to let the audience know where they can find you, your website, any social media, where they can buy your books.
Books should be available anywhere. And my website is derekjensen.org, DerekJensen.org. And I want to thank you again for great questions. It's always fun to talk with you, and I'd love to do it again.
Oh, absolutely, Derek. Thank you so much for being a guest, coming back, man. This has been an excellent conversation. I always enjoy speaking with you. You're so intelligent, very high intellectual, and always makes for great time. So thank you so much. And just want to say to our audience, I really hope you enjoyed this episode as well. Please remember to stay connected with us at thehiddengateway.com. Shoot us an email at support@thehiddengateway.com if you need to chat. And this will conclude this week's episode. Until next time, stay positive. Stay questioning, be love, and be free. The Hidden Gateway, out.